The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. My dear listeners, if you have a father, if you are a father, if you know a father, or if you have ever heard a dad joke, today's episode is for you. Our first story is from the book Farm Girl, Rural Life Humor from a Farmer's Daughter, written by Shanna Hatfield, copyright 2014. The chapter, Don't Tell Your Mother. Upon hearing the shocking news that a baby was on the way, my dad begged and pleaded with my mother to give him another son, since the first two would soon be moving out and starting their own lives. An up-and-coming farmhand would be a bonus he hadn't planned on in his middle age. He ended up with me, a hopeless, romantic, girly girl plagued by hay fever, with a love of reading, baking, and craftiness. However, it didn't take long for Dad to decide I would do quite nicely in place of another boy. As soon as I was out of diapers, I began accompanying him everywhere. The gun rack in his Chevy pickup suddenly no longer held weaponry because I stood on the seat and hung on to it as we bounced across corrugates while Dad irrigated. He installed a special box for me to ride on between the seat and the control panel in the stacker so I could safely go along without fear of falling out the open door. Anyone stepping into the enclosed cab of the swather had to push aside my pink blanket and dolls. I spent hour after hour riding with Dad as he cut hay, sucking on Neckos and Butter Rum Lifesavers. Any number of slight mishaps, exciting treats, and unforeseen incidents occurred over the years during our time together that created an urgent need for my dad to issue a warning to keep the experience just between the two of us. I learned early on when he said, "Don't tell your mother," it was best to heed his advice and not tell Mom. Otherwise, it put an undeniable damper on our adventures. My first memories of hearing those four words came not too long after a day when my sister, feeling uncommonly generous in nature, gave me one of her lifesavers. Overjoyed by the gift, I popped it in my mouth and promptly managed to swallow it whole, causing it to lodge in my windpipe. While I danced around and gasped for air, my mother flew into a full-fledged panic, whacking me on the back hard enough to dislodge several vertebrae had I not been a sturdy child. When that failed to remove the offending circle, she turned me upside down and shook me until I was sure my eyeballs and teeth would roll around her feet long before the piece of candy came out of my mouth. When it finally dropped to the floor, she set me upright. All humans and a few dogs within hearing distance received a long and in-depth lecture about never, ever letting me have another lifesaver. A few weeks after that, Dad and I were on our way to irrigate an acreage he rented a few miles down the road from our farm. To get there, we could take a shortcut along the canal road, or we could drive down the highway and approach on a paved road, driving right past the community store. 9 times out of 10, Dad would swing by the store, much to my pleasure. Dad would open the creaking door to the store, revealing a wonderland of heady aromas and sugary delights. The old wooden floor looked like it had been there since the first pioneers rolled by in their wagons, but it was one of my favorite places in my little world. Although the store carried a small inventory of all the basics to keep locals from having to make the trip into town for milk, bread, eggs, or canned goods, the section that always drew my attention was the candy aisle. They had every type of candy and gum a sugar-craving girl could want. Dad was especially fond of Necco's, but sometimes we got Bit O' Honey, Big Hunk, or a handful of penny candy. On occasion, he'd let me get candy cigarettes, which had to be fully consumed and the box disposed of before we arrived home, because Mom disapproved of them even more than candy in general. Sometimes we'd get an ice cream sandwich from the freezer by the door, or a bottle of Coca-Cola with drops of condensation streaming down the frosty glass. On this particular day, though, I kept coming back to the selection of Lifesavers. Approximately 6 minutes after Mom issued her orders for me to never again place another piece of the candy in my mouth, I forgot about the warning. Aware of the longing in my eye, Dad picked up a roll of butter rum Lifesavers and carried it to the cash register. Once we got in the pickup, he made me sit down instead of standing in my customary spot next to him, broke one of the sweet circles in half, and gave it to me. "Now, don't tell your mother." And I didn't. That day, I learned to break any hard candy into pieces by crunching down on it. And yes, the dentist and I spent many an hour together once all my permanent teeth came in, as well as the fact that if Dad said not to tell Mom, it must be because I was going to get a treat. There were many, many times over the years that Dad would ply me with sweets when Mom would not have approved. There were also many, many times when "don't tell your mother" meant that unless we were prepared to rush her to the hospital from heart failure upon hearing our latest adventure, it was best she not know what happened. Dad and I are both avid subscribers to the "what you don't know can't hurt you" theory. One such incident occurred while Dad and I were stacking hay. Back at that time, Dad still had a baler that shot out bales weighing around 100 pounds or so. It had been my job since I was 11 to ride through every baled field on my motorbike and turn up the flat bales, bales that have tipped over on their side and won't feed into the stacker. This saved the person running the stacker considerable time and irritation because they could breeze through the field picking up bales and not have to stop to turn up the flat ones or leave them and come load them on a flatbed by hand. While it should have sounded like work, I never minded doing it because I got to spend hours on my motorbike away from all supervision, riding out in the fields and kicking over hay bales. It gave me plenty of time for retreating to the sparkly pink world in my head where I dreamed up tales of sweet romance and plotted out my future. On this particular day, Dad decided I could ride with him in the stacker and hop out to flip over a bale when we found one. I rode out to the field on my bike and left it parked at one end. Since I was in high school at the time, I'd long outgrown the little box that still sat between the seat and the controls, so I sat in the open door with my feet resting on the step, bracing myself by holding onto the inside frame of the door. It's probably best to add that both Ford and Dad were of the opinion, since the stacker could be driven at highway speeds, a fact Ford proved driving it back from California when Dad purchased it, that it should be driven as fast as possible while stacking hay. The metallic clang, clang, clang of the bales being picked up and moved back to the bed of the stacker rivaled the whooshing sound made as the big machine roared through the fields like a giant streak of red and yellow tailed by a huge cloud of dust. As we rode through the field, I would point out a flat bale, and Dad would slow the stacker enough I could jump out and hit the ground running. If I failed to move quickly, odds were high he would no longer have a daughter to turn over the hay bales, and cheap farm labor that shared a love of neckos was hard to find. This arrangement worked well for the better part of the afternoon. Dad zoomed along as we indulged in our second roll of lifesavers, having crunched my way through the first one in no time. I thoroughly enjoyed the time spent with my dad, until the front tire of the stacker hit a badger hole. I lost my grip and fell out of the cab, dropping onto my hands and knees. Waiting to be crushed to death under the back tire, I closed my eyes and prayed Mom wouldn't kill Dad when she found out I was dead. Screeching, grinding metal and the thump of all the hay bales shifting on the load caused me to gaze up into the terrified eyes of my dad. He managed to swerve just enough to keep from hitting me by mere inches. Getting to my feet once I recovered the ability to breathe, I limped over to where Dad sat, white-faced on the stacker cab, and quietly regained my seat. Neither of us said a word as he slowly drove to the end of the field where I'd left my motorbike. There was a silent agreement that I would turn the rest of the bales riding on my bike. Before I slid out of the stacker, Dad squeezed my shoulder and said, "I think it best if you don't tell your mother." I nodded my head in agreement. I enjoyed my adventures with Dad too much to be forbidden to ever set foot in the fields again. And I really wasn't up to a trip to the emergency room with Mom. I should state the one time Mom attempted to apply this same logic on me in regard to keeping something from Dad, I failed miserably at the task. Dad asked us to ride out to the hay field on the back hill and move a hand line out of the way so he could start cutting hay. The brilliant plan was to leave my motorbike at one end and the four-wheeler at the other so we wouldn't have to walk all the way back to the head of the line when we finished. I rode my motorbike with Mom trailing along behind on the four-wheeler. Everything went fine until she rode it too close to a steel T-post. The shovel Dad had strapped crosswise on the machine hit the post with a resounding smack. One would expect the shovel handle to break. However, it held steady, flipping the four-wheeler entirely over on top of Mom. Hearing her scream along with a ruckus behind me, I slammed on the brakes in time to watch the four-wheeler go tires up in the air before falling on top of her. Visions of her crushed beneath the four-wheeler flew through my head, and I rushed to her side, ready to provide assistance. When she began lambasting Dad, despite his absence, for strapping the shovel on the four-wheeler in the first place, I knew she'd be fine. The two of us somehow managed to get the four-wheeler upright, and as Mom straightened her blouse and adjusted her hair back into place, she gave me a long, hard look. "You will not tell your father about this." Giving a brief nod that was more of a head shake, as soon as I got within shouting distance of Dad, I called out to him, "Guess what Mom did today?" Her words of caution just didn't hold the same exciting ring as, "Don't tell your mother." Our next story is for the pet dads out there. From the book, Inept, Impaired, Overwhelmed, Tall Tales from West Virginia and Beyond, written by Bill Lepp, copyright 2012. The chapter, Bathing Buck. Buck Dog is a 37-inch irony. Despite being half German Shepherd, Buck is somewhat less than brave. And though he is half Basset Hound, he couldn't track a bunny rabbit in a shoebox. As a matter of fact, Buck is useless in the woods and is basically the equivalent of 5 second-class Boy Scouts in combat boots trying to sneak up on Chief Cornstalk in autumn. When I found out that dogs are descendants of bears, right away I set out to trace Buck's genealogical background in hopes of finding some noble bear in his past. I wanted to counter his inabilities with, if nothing else, distinguished ancestors. I was expecting to find in Buck's line perhaps the bear from Grizzly Adams or Kipling's Baloo. Heck, I would have settled for Winnie the Pooh. What I found instead were strong family ties linking Buck Dog with Fozzie, Yogi, Boo Boo, and about half the bears that showed up in the Far Side cartoons. Another thing I discovered was that bears like to roll around in the worst-smelling stuff they can find in the forest in order to camouflage their scent. This trait Buck has not only inherited, but also mastered, even revolutionized. At least once a week, he finds someone's leftover catfish bait, a cow patty, a diaper, or a dead gopher to roll around in. He's even pointed out a skunk that lives along the route of our nightly walk. Each night, Buck goes to get loose and chase the thing. I honestly believe he wants to get sprayed. Here's the thing, though. Buck's mighty abilities to disguise his scent aside, he ain't worth wet socks in a blizzard when it comes to getting game. There is not a bird, mammal, or snake in the 5-state radius that fears Buck. I mean, let's face it, as much as I love Buck, he was born in the city. Durham ain't New York, but a city is a city, and Buck spent his formative year on the mean streets and tobacco roads. He might be street smart, but he is yet to catch up with his country cousins. Truth be told, when we moved back to West Virginia, I went so far as to borrow a neighbor's coon dog to sort of tutor Buck in the finer points of country living. That's where his primal urge to roll in crap was reignited. And thus, Buck is essentially a 4-legged compost pile headed your way. I've taken the liberty of listening in on a few conversations the local wildlife have had recently, and it isn't pretty. I overheard this conversation four squirrels were having at the base of an old oak tree as Buck approached, upwind. "Hey, you hear something coming?" "Yeah, but from the racket it's making, I bet that's that dog Buck. He's harmless. Let's just sit tight." "Geez, oh wheeze! Whatever it is, it smells like a swine barn." "That's Buck, all right. You can bet your bottom acorn that anything still alive that smells like that has got to be Buck." It isn't easy for me, Buck's faithful owner, to hear things like that. The other day, bless his heart, Buck got loose and rolled in the carcass of what must have been a very dead, very rotten scavenger who must have died long ago of a serious lower bowel blockage. A whole day passed before I could even get close to Buck, and then I had to wait for the company to leave and my wife to go shopping before I could do anything about the stench. Once everyone was gone, though, I dragged Buck into the guest bathroom and locked the door. I ran into the good bathroom and raided it for supplies. I grabbed my wife's wildflower shampoo, daisy soap, lilac aromathy crystals, and apricot bubble bath. Then I gathered up the loofah, the back scratcher, the Ajax, and a pair of latex gloves. I meant business. When I opened the door of the guest bathroom, Buck backed into a corner and started baying a mournful dirge. I turned the water on in the tub and dumped in a liberal dose of lilac crystals, bubble bath, and detergent. I put on an old terry cloth bathrobe over my good jeans and t-shirt, pulled the latex gloves on my hands, and tied my handkerchief over my mouth and nose. I turned to look at Buck. Buck hates to take a bath, and I am used to him being despondent about the prospect, but now the baying had been replaced by a quiet cry, saturated with misery and fear. When I caught my own reflection in the mirror, I understood why. I made for quite a picture. There I was, wearing a long white coat, rubber gloves, and a bandana that looked like a surgical mask tied around my face. The water in the tub was steaming, and the bubbles were oozing over the sides. I looked just like a mad scientist standing before a boiling cauldron, in desperate need of a basset-mixed gizzard, and Buck was plumb scared out of his head. On a good day, there is no chance of coaxing Buck into the tub, and this was not a good day. His hair bristled, and he almost growled. I chuckled at him, and then lunged. I grabbed him just before he could slip behind the toilet and wrestled him into the tub. The fight was on. I had one hand on his collar, and with the other I was scrubbing, lathering, rinsing, and repeating as fast as I could. Buck was bucking, diving, squirming, thrashing, and turning with all the agility of an alligator. Giving Buck that bath was like trying to circumcise a Brahma bull during a rodeo. When I was finally done, the water had gone from warm and soapy to something that resembled tepid borscht. I was half drowned. Buck was thoroughly upset and mostly washed. The Ajax was gone, and the bathroom was flooded. As soon as I let go of his collar, Buck sprang from the tub. Buck, starting from the very tip of his tail, started to shake, slowly at first, but before long he was as consumed as a holy roller in the presence of the spirit. Tiny drops of water flew in every direction, coating the walls, the mirror, the doors, and the ceiling. When he was utterly shook, he looked up at me, and then he stuck his nose as far back along his spine as he could. He slowly brought his nose forward, leaving not one hair unsmelled. And when he was done, he looked up at me and smiled. A peace filled the room, and for a moment all I could smell was bleach, wildflowers, and water. It was as though I was standing in a spring field after a light rain. And then something crawled into the field and died. I figured out why Buck was smiling. He smelled worse now than he ever had before. He smelled like a bouquet of flowers, to be sure, but a bouquet growing out of a cow patty atop a landfill. There was nothing to be done. I waited until dark and took Buck on his nightly walk. When we got to the yard with the skunk, I just plain dropped the leash. Our last story today proves that dads often have the last words, all six of them. From the book Forever Irma, Best Loved Writing from America's Favorite Humorist by Irma Bombeck, copyright 1996. The column essay from July 23, 1969. Men have a six-word limit. I have publicly stated that men speak approximately six words a day in their own homes. A few readers have challenged me and want to know what the six words are. I should have qualified my statement. The six words are not necessarily spoken in sequence, nor are they necessarily spoken to wives. A friend of mine, for example, has a husband who saves his 6 words until the Carson show has signed off and she is fast asleep. Then he snaps on all the lights in the bedroom, punches his pillow, shakes her out of a sound slumber, and says, "Did you turn off the hose?" 6. Some men will blow their quota at one time. They'll garage the car, make tracks to the kitchen, take the lid off the fry pan, and announce loudly, "I had it for lunch." 5. Then realizing he has only used 5 words, he will add, "Yuck!" Others will spend a half dozen words in obscenities directed toward Bobby's bicycle in the driveway. My week gets off to a slow start, but builds to a feverish climax. Monday. Me. Say something. Him. What you want me to say? 6. Tuesday. Me. What kind of day did you have? Him. Don't aggravate me. You wouldn't believe. 6. Wednesday. Me. Try me. Him. Where's the rest of the paper? 6. Thursday. Me. We had a crisis here today. Him. The dog isn't lost, is he? 6. Friday. Me. Guess what? Know who called today? And is coming to dinner? And is bringing her new husband with her? And can't wait to talk your arm off? Are you ready? Him. No, 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 no. 6. Saturday. Me. I'll be out for a while. I've got some errands to do at the shopping center. Him. Admit it. My chattering gets on your nerves. 8. Sunday. Me. Do you know you spoke 8 words to me yesterday? I wouldn't be surprised if you were starting a new trend. Him. Don't count on it. 4. Part of man's silence is woman's doing. We created the strong, silent masculine image. The silence represented deep thought, a repression of emotions. A quiet man was an island of mystery, a challenge to probe and discover as years went on. I always thought a quiet man was subtle and romantic. But that was before I started arguing with the tropical fish over which channel we were going to watch. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.